Hey everybody, it's Brittany Furlan from Worst First Podcast. Have you guys ever had some really bad shit happen to you in your life? Well, we talk about that here on Worst First. We talk about all the bad things that have ever happened to anyone. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're happy, sometimes they make you cry, and sometimes they're terrible. So pause right now and subscribe to Worst First's Podcast with Brittany Furlan, and I guarantee these stories will make you feel a lot better about your own life. And as always, the podcast is free. Who doesn't like something that's free? So come on over to Worst First. Here's some crazy stories. We got some great guests, Bill Burr, Machine Gun Kelly, Tommy Lee. Worst First with Brittany Furlan. Check it out.
This is Dead in Sports. This is the place where sports opinions collide, Dead End Sports. I'm your host, Kenneth B. Edge, coming at you live via Zoom. This is our redraft that we talked about doing last week. We didn't get a chance to do it that Friday or that Saturday, but we're here now. Joining me, as usual, we got Shelton J.
Hey, man, what's going on, bro?
Nikki Duse.
What's going on? What's good?
BZ430.
What up, though?
And P4247.
What it do?
Yep. So we're going to talk about, obviously, the Jimmy Butler thing. We promised you guys that was coming. And we're also going to do the redraft, as you see by the title, and some other stuff as well. The Last Dance premiere last night. So a whole bunch of stuff, man. But, you know, we're on a short time frame somewhat, so we're just going to go ahead and get started.
All right, let's hit him with the Jimmy Butler. We've been having them wait for long enough. We all listened to the interview, or I don't know if JJ Redick got a video of his podcast, but it was an interesting conversation. He does. It was an interesting conversation nonetheless. For me personally, it doesn't really get – the good stuff doesn't happen until, like, what, the last 40, 50 minutes of the podcast, at least for me, as far as when you want – the shit that you want to hear from Jimmy Butler as far as what happened in Philly. So I wanted to get y'all thoughts on just that part of, like, did this interview make y'all look at Jimmy Butler?
Did it make us look at Jimmy Butler different?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, it didn't. I never, you know, I guess from the outside looking in, I never thought that he was, you know, an asshole or whatever, even though he owned up to it in the interview. But, yeah, I just always thought he was just a competitive kind of like throwback type of player, where it's just like he ain't with that soft shit. He just want to go out there and compete at the highest level, and he's not afraid to back down from nobody. That's how I took it from this entire interview.
And he seems like he's always been a straight shooter to me too. Like, so what he says, he means, and he stands behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Steven Jackson, Captain Jack. Like, I love dudes like that, man. I would love to play. I love playing basketball or hooping with dudes that has that mentality or that's kind of like that, because I feel like I'm going to war with somebody that's gonna go to war with me. You know what I'm saying? So I had no issue with it.
Now, it didn't change my perspective on Jimmy Butler at all. I think that when you have a chip on your shoulder, the same way that Jimmy has, you know that there's just a certain level of respect, honor, and leadership that that an organization, a coach, people in position of leadership need to have. And I think for me, it opened my eyes more so to the lack of those things that Philly has, more so than me looking at Jimmy different. Jimmy has been consistent. You know what I'm saying? I think that for me, listening to that interview, it made me look at Philly a lot different.
Yeah, I think I found it very insightful, very revealing about a lot of things, but mainly I'm 100% with FIFO. It really was a huge indictment on Philly, not necessarily the players, but the leadership and the coach. And kind of to also go back to what B was saying about Jimmy Butler as well, man, it just shows that he's a stand-up guy and that he's vilified in the media, because we had J.J. Redick basically corroborate some of the perceptions in terms of the Portland meeting and how that was portrayed in the media versus what actually happened. And J.J., you know, you heard him on there, man. He, you know, if it was the way it was, I don't think he would have, you know, lied about that. I think he would have been very forthcoming. So I think that told me that we have to be mindful of framing in the NBA or just media, sports media in general, when it comes to certain players and their characters. So, but yeah, I mean, because Jimmy said it. He said when he got there the first 2 weeks, he said, I don't know anybody. I'm going to just sit here and just chill because there's a certain image that people have of me that that isn't true. So I'm going to just take a back seat.
And that's what made me look at Jimmy differently because going into this interview, I kind of been very critical of Jimmy Butler as far as like the way he goes from just a secondary source standpoint when I'm reading all this information about that's coming out when he's with these different organizations and how he turns a lot of people off as what it seems from based off the reporting that I was like, what are you doing all this for? Like, you should be more of a team player. You should be more accommodating to your teammates. But after this interview, listening to how JJ praised him, just how he thinks and how he talks, it makes a lot of sense. So when I'm seeing – so when I'm just going back and forth as far as what I've been reading to how he actually is, it makes me think like, oh, I should be more on his side than the media side. I should be listening to the results more than the actions because clearly we just watched a documentary of a man who is hard on his teammates because he wants to win. And we glorify that for the 90s, but nowadays I think for me – I've kind of shunned that. So coming out of that interview, I've got to gain a lot more respect for Jimmy Butler. And it kind of validated my thoughts on the 76ers organization as far as that whole rebuild process, even up till now. Like, he kind of definitely confirmed some of my thoughts as far as how that organization has been run.
Nick, you're such a millennial, bro. Like the fact that like look, even though I know I'm a millennial too, by the year that I was born, I still have like some of the ideologies of the previous generation, especially when it comes to sports and stuff like that. Like the fact that like I knew for a fact that Jimmy Butler in Minnesota went into practice, called out Cat and Wiggins and bust they ass with second, third, fourth stringer, people from the grocery store, it didn't matter. But the fact that how the media portrayed that as a negative thing, I was sitting there, I'm like, no, like that's what your best player should do. Your best player should challenge every other person in that organization, from the owner down to the damn ball boy.
But for me, better. But for me, it was just more about, like, not everybody learns the same way. So it seems like, for me, at the time, it was just like, you're doing all this rah-rah shit, but it's not getting you the results that you want, let alone it's not even keeping you on that team. So why are you keep doing that?
They made what the media did was they made that seem like it wasn't about basketball and making people better. They tried to make it seem like they vilified him for being outspoken and feeling like he felt and tried to make it seem like he was just bullying at that point. So that's the difference. That's a different word today. Bullying is the word. It's a bad thing as opposed to then. You know, when you are a stand-up guy, you just want the best from everybody around you.
And that's really what you're trying to get at. It is the fact that if you're competing for a championship or you're trying to get the organization to a point to start truly competing for a championship outside of talent, that journey is going to be difficult. And if you think that me coming at your neck at practice is hard, what do you think is going to happen when, you know, Cat got four fouls, when Wiggins is like 3 for 13 and gets down 7 with 4 minutes to go in game 6? And if we lose, we go home. Thanks. What is harder, this practice or that situation? This practice, me getting on your ass, get you ready for that moment. Cat, no, you can't foul in these last 4 minutes. Wiggins, I know you've been struggling, but you know what? Even though you may not hit this jumper, I need you to get a couple of defensive stops. I need to be able to call y'all out when all of the pressure is on you and you not fold. And if you're folding in practice, trade me.
Yep. Yeah. How can I go to war with you when you folding in damn practice, man?
In practice?
Yeah.
Practice? We talking about practice? Come on, man. Come on.
Get your ass on somewhere.
So let me ask y'all something from listening to it.
Hold on. Okay. The reason why I'm not disagreeing with anything you just said, FIFO. My thing was more of, I didn't think there was a conversation. Like, when Jimmy Butler was describing, like, bro, like, I'm not, like, I'm honest. Like, I can come up to you and talk to you like I am and elaborate on how I'm feeling about certain things. And if I don't see a result happen, then I'll take it another way. I didn't think that's what was going on. I thought Jimmy was just one way. Like, that's how he acts. That's how he is. But I can see there's more to him, which is what he elaborated on. Like, I can do it in a different multitude of ways. Like, I didn't even say shit when I first got here. I was quiet. So I know that there's more ways he can communicate himself. So I didn't think that's what was happening. That's why I reacted to the way he was, like, quote-unquote bullying those players. And I'm like, if this is what you always do, then you're going to get the same results. But from what I've learned is that he's communicated in different ways with other teammates what he likes to be done or what he thinks should be done. And if they don't listen and then they still lose, then that makes sense.
But Nick, like, I think that 90% of people that play basketball, their persona on the court is different than them off the court. You know what I'm saying? And the reason why I say that is because I've told this story several times. Everybody knows Modest Media. Modest Media is the most calm, cool, collective dude I know. You know what I'm saying? But on that basketball court, he's a different animal. Even though I know I can be rah-rah, bro, as a coach, as a basketball player, it's a whole nother level. And I understand that about basketball players. So when I saw that story about Jimmy Butler coming at his teammates, I'm like, that's 100%. That's what needs to happen. Like, you have to be tough on the basketball court so that way everything else is easier. Everything else now goes into place. Because guess what? If I'm checking you and I'm cussing you out and I'm telling you how you're not doing well on the basketball court, guess what happens after practice? And we go back to the crib or like, you know what, let's go get some drinks. You know what, let's go chill. Now we can have a civilized conversation based upon what happened. But you need to be able to maintain your – even if you don't maintain your composure, you want to punch me and we fight. That's good too. That's good too, because we got to be able to talk it out on the back end. But at the end of the day, on the basketball court, conflict is not a bad thing.
And it's going to happen, man. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's been going on since before social media. Like, yeah, I'm pretty sure Isaiah, Magic, Kareem,
all of them
probably was arguing with their teammates. Bill Russell, Wilcher. Like, I'm pretty sure they all was getting on their teammates.
I'll give you a prime example.
It happened on the documentary. We saw it in the documentary yesterday.
Austin Rivers. Austin Rivers was a top high school prospect, right? Obviously, his dad, Doc Rivers, coached the Boston Celtics. Obviously, he would come to practice and stuff like that. He would play KG, Paul Pierce, all of these guys one-on-one. And if Austin Rivers lost, he wanted to fight, bro. And we talking Austin Rivers, man. Austin Rivers is a role player in the NBA. You know what I'm saying? That just shows the level of emotion, the level of engagement, how emotionally distraught you can get when things don't go your way. You know what I'm saying? And I think, again, as a leader, you got to be able to display that without the media or any outside bodies criticizing that. Because at the end of the day, that makes a team better. That galvanizes a team. So that way they understand when the tough get going, like we've already experienced that. We've already been through that. We know what it is. Now all we got to do is just raise our game, raise our expectation, and let's go get it accomplished.
And going off of that leadership and how that translates to the organization holistically, you guys mentioned about the 76ers and your viewpoints before and after listening to the interview. So I want y'all to elaborate on that as far as how do y'all feel about the organization during Jimmy Butler's time and after Jimmy Butler's time?
I'll put it to you like this. I was most it was Brett Brown. You know, the fact that, you know, you're in these meetings – you're doing film study, but you're just like kind of just going through the motion. And what Jimmy was saying is like, how is this getting us better? You know what I'm saying? So to me, that's coming from the Spurs coaching tree, and also seeing how Philly did play hard at times before they even got the Jimmy Butler and the Tobias Harris's of the world. Once they drafted, you know, all of the youngins and they were going through the process, you saw that team at times played hard. So for Jimmy and also JJ Redick to kind of see it through the same lens that is like, yo, what, like what the hell are we doing? And those are two NBA veterans. That's an indictment on Brett Brown holistically. And I was just like, I thought he was better than that.
It definitely is an indictment on Brett Brown. You know, I've been watching Philly for a few years with the NBA League Pass and watching just about every game, but leadership has definitely been lacking. It's not a question about that. And you see that with development of players. You look at Ben Simmons, we talk about him shooting and stuff like that. Maybe with another coach, he would have at least worked on his game a little bit more and started showing that shot. So that alone shows me that we're not getting the leadership in Philly that we needed. But my question too to y'all is, what do y'all think J.J. Redick's role in all of this is? Because to me, as a player, I feel like if you're a veteran, you're the team leader, shouldn't you have been the one to kind of take Jimmy under your wing and say, look, this is how it is, X, Y, Z? Or shouldn't you be the one stepping up saying something? Why should
J.J. was echoing the same thing that Jimmy was. Like, how can I take a leadership role if I don't know where we're going? Like, there's no sense of direction from – it seems like from multiple levels throughout the organization, like any room you went into, there was people saying one thing and doing another.
Well, let's give just a little bit of leeway to Elton Brand because he was new in that situation.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So typically when we talk top down in an organization, the owner, depending on the owner, we don't really take too much of what he's saying. It really starts at the general manager because the GM is the filter for what the owner wants to do, say, and direction. Elton Brand was really new there. Mm-hmm. But Brett Brown has been there from day one of the process.
Right. And I get now ultimately it's Brett Brown's fault, but my thing is, as a player, you know, we talk about being former players, you have a team leader that is somebody that's in charge, that's the leader on the team. Like, we talk about Jordan all the time. Jordan would have had that meeting, I would have thought, with Elton when he came in. Like, look, what are we going to do? Like, what is this looking like? Because this ain't really – you know, somebody has to sit down with the owner or the GM, rather, and try to sit down with the head coach and say, well, look, I'm representing the team. That shouldn't have been Jimmy because Jimmy's new. That should have been J.J. because J.J. was the veteran leader of that team. So it's more on him to kind of take that buffer.
But at the same time, maybe J.J. doesn't have that voice. And maybe that's not naturally or comfortably where J.J. wanted to be. Maybe he's more of like a coach's voice in terms of the players and individual work habits and things of that nature and being a veteran in that sense. Because I think J.J. knew, like, you know, he signed a pretty short-term deal. He knew he wasn't necessarily going to be there long term. And JJ is a journeyman. JJ is not part of the process, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if JJ felt like that was his place to do or say something like that. And then when you look at Embiid and Ben Simmons, is that in their DNA to be
them? No, I wouldn't expect to be them. Who was the team captain last year for them? Let me see who it was because I don't even know.
Why you looking that up, Shelton? I want to get B and Ken's thoughts on it. As far as the 76ers and how they've been your thoughts and perceptions on it before and after the interview.
Well, to hear Jimmy and JJ talk about the coaches session, that was concerning for him to not coach, to not call anybody out, for him to make those sudden changes in the playoffs that people didn't seem to really agree with. It shows that he's really holding them back. And for them to get as far as they got with him seemingly maxing out his coaching potential or lack thereof, I only imagine where they could be right now if they had another coach and that actually did some coaching, that actually had more different ideas on what to do with that roster with Embiid, Tobias Harris, Ben Simmons, all those guys. They're winning a lot of this off talent, you know, and I'm not discrediting Brett Brown. He's had a lot to do with it as well, but he's also the reason why they hadn't gotten to the title. And we look a lot at the players, what Ben Simmons isn't doing, why Embiid can't stay healthy, et cetera, et cetera. But in spite of all of that, they were a shot away, a shot that bounced off the rim for like 7 seconds or so, or seven bounces. So, yeah, man, it just told me that he will be the reason why they don't win a title.
B, what's up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my perception of them before that interview was, you know, something must be going on in the front office for them to break that up and not try to, you know, give it another run after they came, like Ken mentioned, a couple of bounces away from being in the Eastern Conference Finals against Milwaukee, which they actually had a chance. But and then after that interview, it just kind of solidified, like, yeah, that's why, because of coaching. And I think I want to say we've kind of preached or kind of questioned Brett Brown in the past years, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? So and I think that interview just really shed some light on to where we're like, okay, this is why Sixers are going to never get to where we think they can get to, and this is why they haven't been, you know, getting to that next level before that interview. So, yeah, it's the coaching, man. So, I mean, this – and that shows people always try to, like, knock coaching, like, oh, coaching doesn't play that much of a part, or coaching doesn't – it does, man. Like, you really got to put these players in position to succeed as a coach. That's, like, your job as a head coach to really try to – now, of course, yeah, you're not out there literally playing the games and stuff, but you're still putting your players in position. And people can attest this. As a coach, you have to put your players in position to be successful. And Brett Brown is just – he's just not doing it. I mean, he's got them up to a point, but to get them over that hill – and to the promised land, as we would say in NBA terms, he's not the coach to do that. So I think they should look at getting another coach, and that can better develop Ben Simmons a little more. I mean, Ben Simmons is a hell of a talent, and maybe we still got to give him a couple more years to develop a jump shot. Because like I said, Jason Kidd, he went a whole bunch of years before he ended up being a knockdown three guy. So maybe we might see that with Ben Simmons in another 2, 3, or 4 years. I don't know. But he should definitely develop into having a respectable jump shot.
It's a piggyback off of what B's saying. I think the biggest measurement of how good of a coach is based off of what the players do on the court is it's all about execution. Mm-hmm. And when I say execution, it doesn't mean make or miss the shot. Right. It means how on a string is everybody together, mm-hmm. right? And we saw, and I know I'm jumping a little bit ahead to the Jordan documentary or the Bulls documentary, but when Pippen wasn't there, Steve Kerr said that we had to readjust because Pippen did so many things on this court. And mm-hmm. eventually the Bulls got it together, right? You had to overcome that. But the reason why Pippen was so important was because Phil Jackson made Pippen so important.
Yeah.
Phil Jackson understood, yep. Okay, this guy can do all of this. We don't really need a point guard. We're going to let him do what he do. You know what I'm saying? So that's on the coach, the execution.
And like you said, it's even the adjustment that they made. Like he talked about him playing off the ball and him playing on the ball, thinking he should be on the ball more, making that adjustment for that series. It's a lot into it, man. It's a lot. It's X's and O's are just as important as the plays. Now, coming down the stretch, get the man, the best man with the ball in his hands. But during the game, it's got to make sense. And that's what I think he's lacking.
And for me, it was just, again, confirmation that Brett Brown should have been fired 2 years ago. I think they should have got somebody like Mark Jackson in there. I know everybody's been preaching for Mark Jackson, but I think he was actually – one of the best coaches for this situation when it comes to just a foundation of leadership. And I don't really know what happens to Philly after this, because it sounds like there's a lot of talks of potentially blowing up the team as far as getting rid of either Embiid or Simmons. And from what I'm heard from an interview, it sounds like it was just one coach away from changing up that whole dynamic and that whole team. So, but at this point in time, it seems like the players in the organization are setting their ways of being dysfunctional, because I don't see how this turns around in a year or two, to be honest. If it's this dysfunctional from the GM to the head coach to the players, that's not a quick turnaround.
I don't think they're setting their ways. You just need the right coach. You need a you know, as the saying goes, a leader among men.
Yes.
And yeah, he'll.
But they have to fire Brett Brown first, and they don't seem –
But just that's on the assumption that Brett Brown is gone. That's what I was saying.
But I'm saying, like, they're content with how things are by re-signing of his contract.
Oh, but they'll move off of him Yeah, I think there are rumors
before,
that.
Before they trade, before they give up on Embiid or, and as a and then Simmons as a unit.
Yeah,
it would be a smart thing to do. Yeah,
they were talking about getting rid of Brett Brown this year, weren't they?
It's out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they'll move on. I don't think it's a problem. I think that they gave one more shot, and I don't think they're going to be happy with the results. Well, I know they weren't happy with the results with where they finished this year. So I think that they'll be – I think he'll be out next year. That's what I think anyway. And
I think he could be out by the end of this year, honestly, because the Brett Brown, especially after last year, was on a very short leash, right? Because with all of that talent, let's be honest, they had the most talent in the East. It wasn't
close. Oh, yeah.
Should have won. And obviously they were a shot away, but they shouldn't have been in that position. They should have won the East. I think Brett Brown, if they would have won the East, he would have been – We wouldn't have questioned him. But because they lost, he was on a very short leash. Yes. Obviously, injuries, things happen. But Philly shouldn't have been where they were, even given everything that happened.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And I think because of that, 100% Brett Brown got to go. Yes. Now, whether they make a roster move, you know, blowing it up or just redirecting their direction, something has to happen. Mm-hmm. One, if not both of those things need to happen. So I think now we got to look at Elton Brand, because this is why, you know, you're a GM. This is why, you know, you get paid the big bucks to make these type of decisions. So before, like I said, we had to give Elton Brand a little bit of leeway. He was brand new. He shook it up. He made them, in terms of talent, a championship contender. Obviously, it didn't work out. But that's what you pay him to do, is to move things, to elevate. And if it doesn't work out, okay, how do we – Sam Presti, Jerry Krause even, you know what I'm saying? How do we redirect in a very quick manner without losing our trajectory to compete? So now we got to look at Elton Brand, and now the onus is on him. Now the eyes need to be on Elton Brand. It's no longer on Brett Brown. I wouldn't even say it's on Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. We kind of know what they are. We know what they should be, but that's going to be up to the next coach. And you're now right. Got to look at how Elton Brand handles and manages this situation, because if he mishandles this, Philly's championship run is over, and you're going to be going through another process.
Right, and you're right. And to correct myself, we're saying the same thing. He's not going to be back next year, is what I was saying.
Okay,
and well, the thing signed, about it is
he signed until 2022.
That don't matter. That don't matter. The thing about it is what I and you're right about the Elton Brand thing, and to expand on that a little bit, Elton Brand brought in Al Horford, which I thought was a horrendous move. Personally, I did. So that was all chips in, though, with him and Tobias Harris. So they got all their chips on the board now. So it's really up to getting the right coach in there to coach this team, if it's possible, or they're going to blow it up.
You thought it was a horrendous move? Why you thought it was a horrendous move? I think that was a good move, locker room rise.
You talking about the contract, right? Not the actual move itself.
Yeah, the contract.
Oh, okay.
What they gave him?
Never mind.
Yeah, that was a lot of money, man, to give up for a duplicate player. We already got a big man on that squad. They didn't need Al Horford in there playing out of position, which is what they have right now. So he's playing the four. Well, now Horford is a five. He can't play the four anymore. Not anymore. So is with Joel Embiid, unless Joel Embiid goes down, then it makes sense. But otherwise, it just didn't make sense to give him all that money for 4 years.
So as we were looking at the 76ers organization, my last question to y'all really about this interview was like, how do y'all look at the Miami Heat organization after hearing about what Jimmy Butler had to say about how Pat Riley runs it, the guys that they got in that locker room, and basically how competitive it is, even though they are going through their post-Heatles, you know, rebuild.
I'm not surprised, because look at every place Pat Riley has been, right? Like, he was with the Lakers. We know, even though they were Showtime, it wasn't – they didn't lack for scrappiness. You know what I'm saying? Like those boys were still scrappy. We know his tenure in New York, what that looked like. You know what I'm saying? And now even – pre-Heatles, we know what Miami was about, right? Like, we knew what Tim Hardaway, Jamal Mashburn, Thunder Dan, and Alonzo Mourning was about, right? We knew that. That was Pat Riley. We knew when the Heatles came and they put a defensive-first mindset, we knew what that was about. we knew Eric Spoelstra. We like there is no smokescreen with a Pat Riley led organization. We're going to work hard. We're going to get players that, you know, if they're not the most talented, they're going to work it harder than any other person. You know what I'm saying? So that culture is always set. And I think the most interesting thing is looking at it from Pat Riley's perspective is that he's still able to accomplish that in 2020, right? When we're talking about how players are soft and they're too friendly and they're this and they're that and all this, that, and the third is that Pat Riley is still able to get that culture set, and it's the ball just keeps rolling. And when you look at the draft pick, right, Bam Adebayo, I questioned Bam, you know what I'm saying, when he was drafted, not because of the talent, just because of fit. Obviously, they still have Hassan Whiteside, but I knew he was going to work hard. I just didn't know what's his role, you know what I'm saying? Because when they drafted him, I thought Udonis Haslam off bat. Obviously, the game wasn't there just yet. Bam is added to his game. He got jumper and stuff and things like that now. But I saw Udonis Haslam. So I knew eventually it would work, but there was other things that needed to happen. When you look at Duncan Robinson, when you look at what's the other white boy that they just drafted? Tyler Hero. When you look at all of those other guys, like those guys weren't necessarily highly touted, highly rated. So you knew that they were going to work. And for Jimmy Butler being drafted 30th, being they didn't even play for his first 2 years. Like, you knew what he was about, and you knew that that type of moxie lend itself well with what Pat Riley wants to bring to the table. So hearing certain things about the Miami Heat organization, I've been knew that about Pat. So that was not new for me, you know, at all. And I just, for me, it, you know, when you started thinking about, okay, where can Jimmy go, you start thinking about fit, because it wasn't necessarily about winning. And I said that at the end of last year, right, because I felt that if he really wanted to win, stay in Philly because they just have the most talent. Now, yeah. I'm not saying that the Miami move isn't for winning. It's just they aren't necessarily a championship contender year one. You know what I'm saying? But you knew that it was going to be a good fit. That all of these things, how the media was spinning it and all, that wasn't going to come out of Miami because Pat Riley don't run his ship that way.
Mm-hmm. And it goes to show you, too, back to what we were talking about player development. Like you said, look at a team like Miami with Bam and with Tyler and them. Those guys developed quickly because they had the right coaching and structure around them. If Philly had that type of structure, then we'd be talking about a championship. You know what I'm saying? So that's the difference. Bam has developed. It took Bam, what, a year?
About two
to get where he is now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And here we are still. Look, what year is this with Ben Simmons? We're still waiting on Ben to even get, you know, we're not even turned the corner yet. And Joel is nice because Joel has natural abilities, but we're still waiting on him to develop the leadership part. You know what I'm saying? The maturity still is not there. So – that's what I'm saying about Philly, and that's why you know everything that he said was corroborated, because we know that by watching Philly that it's a soap opera. So yeah,
that interview. I think what it told me. I got three things. They're all quick, actually. One, culture matters a lot, and if you have the right organizational culture, it has a significant bump. And everybody, if this was 2K, those ratings would go up +2, +3 for certain players. The second thing is that we haven't heard any noise out of Miami from Jimmy, not a peep, because he's at a place that fits who he is as a person.
100%.
And the third thing, and that's my takeaway from that, watching that whole thing, was that for a lot of players, the NBA is just another damn job, because the things that they were complaining about, the hotel stay, the restaurants, why we got to work during All-Star weekend, why we not getting tickets. If that didn't sound like some regular people stuff.
It really did. It really did, dude.
Yeah, man. So those are my takeaways.
B, what was yours?
I thought you asked me already.
For Miami, like his thoughts on Miami.
Oh yeah. I echo Ken's sentiment because sentiments exactly. When I was watching that, I was like, man, culture, having a good team structure and culture, it really helps. It really helps the success. Because if you look at it, most teams that are successful or that go on runs for multiple years, whether it be, you know, straight NBA finals or straight Eastern Conference or West Conference finals, they have a great culture. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, like the Miami years, the Heatles years, the Detroit Pistons runs from the 03 to like 08, like it was culture, man, all about culture. So when you have a good system in place, you know, for your team to succeed, I think it helps, man. It matters, man. I think Jimmy Butler, and when he start, you can notice his face too. When he started talking about Miami, like his whole mood kind of changed. You know, he was all jokely and giddy and shit. But when it was like Philly, it was more like serious and like, all right, I'm trying to tell y'all what the fuck happened here while I was at Philly. But like when it was Miami, it's like, oh yeah, this shit is completely different. Like we something. Sposha, he don't mind Sposha getting in people's, you know, getting in your face whenever it's something. You know, like Jimmy liked that shit. So when you in an environment like that, you know, I can see Jimmy probably staying there. Like, if the culture stays like that, Jimmy could probably be like, look, I'm a retire in Miami Heat. Like, I'm going to stay here until my playing days are over. So, and it looks like the way he was talking to JJ, it seemed like he had that attitude. Like, he was going to say that. Like, I just feel like this is where I'm going to finish my basketball career at. And, yeah, man, it was good to see that he perked up once he started talking about the Heat organization because, you know, culture matters, man. It definitely does when you plan for organization.
And again, to piggyback off of what V's saying in terms of Jimmy Butler staying there, here's the thing. Like, Jimmy wouldn't stay there if this is the roster from now until 3-5 years from now. But what do we know about Pat Riley?
Oh, he's going to make moves.
Exactly.
He's going to hustle and bustle, boy. He is going to hustle. He's going to
get some names in there.
Yeah.
While Jimmy is here and Jimmy's still playing at this level, we got Bam and we got some of these other youngins. Oh, we're going to get another name. He's going to persuade. I don't know what the hell Pat Riley, I don't know what kind of mob ties he has, but he's going to get somebody, bro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with everything y'all said. I think with Miami, I thought Jimmy went there just because it's Miami, of course, nice weather and all that, and he was going to get a pay. I don't know, could Philly pay him more or as much as Miami did?
He got more in Miami, I believe.
So, yeah, I thought he was just going for the paycheck and the good weather. But like obviously listening to this interview, it was like a baby bear situation where he was in Minnesota too soft. Philly was dysfunctional. Chicago maybe was too hard, and Miami is now just right. Like it has everything that you will want.
Chicago at least for was dysfunctional too. That was the reason why he eventually wanted out. Once they got rid of who's my guy? Once they got rid of Thibodeau, that. What we know about Chicago is that it's always been dysfunctional. They just have had success despite that.
You know what I mean?
And once Thibodeau got let go, there was no more guiding light for Jimmy. So Jimmy was like, all right, I'm out, which is the reason why when Thibodeau had all of the power at Minnesota, he made a trade for his guy. Jimmy was his guy. He got there. The rest of the young talent wasn't ready for Thibodeau and Jimmy Butler.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that ownership needs to have that conversation with those players and be like, man the hell up. But at the end of the day, you're not going to get rid of Cat. At the end of the day, they finally got rid of Wiggins, but you're not going to get rid of Cat. Cat is going to be your future. So what did they do? They got rid of Thibodeau, then they got rid of Jimmy.
Yeah, I just feel like I've gained even more respect from Miami, just like FIFA, like you mentioned, like they always make moves. Like no matter, you can look back for the last 20 years and they've always made moves to put themselves in the race to be competitive at least, let alone to be a championship contender. So I'm excited to see where Miami goes moving forward. Giannis could potentially be, you know, groomed to go down there. You never know. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what Miami has in store. All right. Anything else on the Jimmy Butler interview? Y'all good?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yes, sir.
All right, so let's get to it. This is the – what is this? The first edition?
2011, yeah. The first edition, 2011 NBA redraft.
2011? I thought it was 12. No, I was joking.
Bro, you was about to get booted out of the damn chat, boy.
I know, right?
All right, so basically the way that we're doing it is that everybody has a particular pick. Who has the first pick?
I do.
Nick has the first pick. Who got the second pick?
I do.
Shelton got the second pick. Third pick?
Third. I got the third pick.
You got third. Ken got fourth, and I got fifth. We're all going to have three draft picks. So, obviously, number one has number one. Number five has number five. The second pick will be whoever has number five has number 10, and then up to number 15. We know that's one outside of the lottery, but to make it work, that's what we're doing. So, the draft order is number one, Cleveland. Number two, Minnesota. Number three, Utah. Number four, Cleveland. Number five, Toronto. Number six, Washington. Number seven, Sacramento. Number eight, Detroit. Number nine, Charlotte. Number 10, Milwaukee. Number 11, Golden State. Number 12, Utah. Number 13, Phoenix. Number 14, Houston. And number 15, Indiana. And that's where we're stopping our redraft.
All right. So,
Nick, you're on the board.
You're on the board, man.
Number one with Cleveland. Now, remember that roster. That's pre-LeBron.
This is
post-LeBron.
Yeah, post-LeBron.
Miami.
Mm-hmm. Byron Scott is the head coach.
Byron Scott's the head coach.
And from looking at this roster, their guards are trash. So, of course, I'm going to actually –
Kyrie only played 10 games at Duke, so who you
only played
with?
10 games at Duke, but he was – shit, he balled out. And based off of the Cavs roster and based off of how I know that head coach is, since we just got done having a conversation about fit and culture, I need a guard that can get his own regardless, and I'm going to go with Kyrie Irving.
So you're still taking Kyrie. Even though today you know.
Hey, man, let that man pick who he has to pick, man.
No, he already took him.
I'm picking him, but I'm saying I'm going off of the rookie year. You always say 3 to 5, and his 3 to 5, he came out busting. So I'm going with Kyrie Irving because, again, based off of just the team itself, I can't really expect the Cavs to develop any other player really to the level of a Kyrie Irving. So I'm just trusting off the skills of a guy coming straight out of college.
All right, number two.
So it's on me.
Yeah, with Minnesota.
Yes, Minnesota.
Who you take?
First off, I want to thank Nick so much, man. I appreciate you. I'm taking Kawhi Leonard, of course, the greatest player in that draft, the true number one pick, Kawhi Leonard. Who's been better?
Nobody in this draft.
In this draft, there's not a question as the overall number one is Kawhi. So I'm definitely taking him on that Minnesota roster. That roster needed leadership anyway. And what better leader? I was prepared to take Jimmy Butler second, but he looked out for me, so I appreciate that. I got Kawhi Leonard.
Ooh, all right. You know my third pick, man.
Wait, hold on. Before you go, B. So, Shelton, who are some of the players that was on that roster that you felt that Kawhi would have, done good with?
On that roster, they had Michael Beasley was there. I like Michael Beasley always. I think he didn't get shot. But Kevin Love was in there, and he was actually the man on that team. And I think Kawhi would have teamed up nice with Kevin Love. Point guard situation, they had Ricky Rubio already. And J.J. Barea was there, too, for the backup point guard spot. But Ricky Rubio, he probably needed a little help. And I thought about, like Kyrie at that number two position. But once again, Kawhi is just outstanding. Just, he's just going to bring that work mentality. That's why I said my second pick would have been Jimmy Butler for the same reason. That team just needed some toughness to it. And Kawhi is it. So it wouldn't have been a question. He was the best. Plus, we taking the best player in that draft, knowing what we know today.
What we know today.
Period is Kawhi. It's not even.
Yeah. So, B, Utah. Who you taking number three?
I'm looking at their roster now with shooters. Give me Klay Thompson.
Mm.
Klay Thompson. Man, like you gotta think at this time, Deron Williams was easy like top five PG in the league. You had him. You still had Mimic Okoro who was solid. You had Paul Millsap who was solid. I had defensive presence in
Andre Kirilenko.
Yep. And I had a young Gordon Hayward who was just coming off his rookie year.
Mm-hmm.
If you add Klay Thompson to this, and I got Derek Favors, Man, Roger Bell coming off the bench. Man, oh man, yeah. Clayton, yeah. And I'm looking at this as a GM of FIFO. I'm not just gonna pick the best player. I'm picking that, like, I think the player that will fit.
Yep.
This particular roster well. That's as soon when Shelton picked this player, I was like, all right, you know who I got? Like Klay Thompson. Like, yep. That shit gonna fit well.
So like, look, before Ken, before you go, look, this is how I know that somebody just need to give me about $300,000-$400,000 a year to go run organization. Because on my draft big board, I don't know if y'all gonna be able to see it. Maybe not.
Nah, not really. Yeah.
It is what it is. Kawhi Leonard was number one on my draft big board, Kyrie number two, and Klay number three. And it wasn't based off of who's drafting, it was just based off of the talent in the draft, knowing what we know now.
Yep.
All right, so I'm up.
Yep, you're up next. And you are drafting for Cleveland again.
Yeah, so this was tricky because I'm drafting for the same organization that Nick is with the number one pick.
Mm-hmm.
So he already took Kyrie.
Mm-hmm.
Klay
and Kawhi off the board.
Klay and Kawhi are off the board. That team, I could have made do. Looking at that roster, I think they had Antoine Jameson was on that team. I don't know if he came back for the next year, but they had a power forward. They had a center. Virajo was there. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to go Jimmy, man. We need a small forward. They only had CJ Miles, Alonzo Gee, Amari Caspi, and that's it. So when you got a Kyrie who's a defensive sieve, he has the grit and grind, and he's an offensive weapon, but I need that three solidified. Somebody's going to be a dog as well. So give me Jimmy Butler. I wanted Klay Thompson. I was hoping B wouldn't pick him. But, yeah, for this team, we need a three, so I'm going to go with Jimmy.
Yeah. I thought you was going to find another K name. We was doing all Ks, Kyrie, Kawhi.
Now, yeah, I mean, for this team, I mean, I couldn't go Kemba, you know, because we already got Kyrie. So.
Yeah, you got to go. Yeah.
Give me Jimmy.
And that's so crazy. Like, on my big board, I literally have the first four picks that y'all took as the best options. So I'm drafting fifth with Toronto. And when I look at their roster, you could tell that they're searching for a direction. They already have DeMar DeRozan, which is obviously the main component of moving that organization forward, but they didn't really have anything else. So with the fifth pick, originally Toronto took Jonas Valanciunas, but I'm taking Kemba Walker. I want a dynamic backcourt. I want somebody that is clutch, which that is Kemba. I don't know too much about DeMar in terms of the clutch factor, but I think that elevates that backcourt to one of the best in the league. So I'm taking Kemba number five. All right, number six, Nick, who you got for Washington?
For the Washington Wizards, this one is actually tough since Jimmy is off the board. I was hoping he was going to last a little bit, at least to this pick, because John Wall, obviously this is before Bradley Beal, but this is John Wall's team, and they do need a guard. But since Jimmy's off the board, I'm going to select Marcus Morris, the better of the twins, who's been playing for Boston and now currently plays for the Clippers. I just like his aggressiveness, his toughness, defense. You could place him anywhere. He's a 3-and-D guy, and he always seems to get his buckets and doesn't really rile the locker room like that. And I think he'll do well with Washington.
Marcus Morris?
Yeah, Marcus.
Okay.
Because looking at their forwards right now, they just got the names that just stick out to me is just Rashard Lewis, and that's about it. So I think he could balance having two good wings on the and they still got a young JaVale McGee who was balling back in the day.
He wasn't balling.
So yeah, I think Marcus Morris would have been good for this team.
I definitely have to slightly disagree with you just because of the names that are still on the board. I think that we all know, knowing now, JaVale McGee had all of the upside. He's just now realizing some of that today, but he never materialized into being one of the best centers in the NBA, right?
During this time, he was rising up. This is before he got traded to Denver, where he got big paid. But he was a big, dominant big man.
But he was awkward. He never averaged more than 12 points. Look it up. Like, he was – so, to me, when you're leaving Nikola Vucevic on the table, which is a 2010 guy, you're also leaving Jonas Valanciunas on the table. You're also leaving Enes Kanter on the table. You know what I'm saying? All three of those guys, to me, are better than JaVale McGee has ever been.
I'm looking at a guard-forward standpoint as far as combination, because that's where, to me, that's – they've kind of helped it with the guard with John Wall, but they need a better forward. Because as far as big man going – moving forward in the league, John Wall needed that more than a big man.
Well, what about Tobias? To me,
Tobias Harris?
Yeah, he's more versatile than Marcus. Slightly smaller.
I like Marcus more than Tobias. Ooh. I like Marcus more than Tobias.
That's not what the paychecks say.
Wow.
That's not what the markets say. But that's cool.
I mean, I'm looking at Tobias now. Tobias ain't doing shit for Philly, so keep it a buck.
He's almost a 20-point scorer. He has been.
Yeah.
He can play, man.
Mm-hmm.
He can play.
Yes, sir.
All right, so number seven, we got Sacramento, and then that is going to go to Shelton. Who you taking to Sacramento, Shelton?
My Sacramento pick would be who you just mentioned. I think I would take Tobias Harris. I think he has the most talent on the board. I think if he had came in on a squad, he's a journeyman basically now, and that's because it was hard to try to find him a fit. But I think a team where he could have came in and immediately done what he does, he'd be straight. And I think he would have been good there because they really didn't have anybody on that Sacramento roster that was of note other than Tyreke Evans at the time. So DeMarcus Cousins at the five. So I think he would have slid right in at that 3-4, that tweener role with that team and been running. And that would have been the guy. So Tobias is my guy.
Next pick is Detroit, and that goes to B.
That's crazy how that shit fall right on me. Yep. I'm picking for Detroit pick. That's fucking hilarious. And yeah, this roster.
Y'all took Brandon Knight. Who you taking in the
this region? Roster was freaking horrible, man. Oh my god, this was definitely when we was about to rebuild, and we're definitely I'm drafting this as if I'm a GM right now, and y'all picking the players that y'all picking, and of course knowing what we know now, and we're definitely soft at the front court because we had Ben Wallace past his prime. We had fucking Chris Wilcox. We had Greg Monroe. That was he was just coming off his rookie year, and we had Jason Maxwell. So I would pick, knowing that what I know now. I can't pronounce his name. Nikolai
Vucevic.
Yeah, Vucevic. I would get him. Knowing what I know now and what this roster needed, I would draft him. I was gonna get if Tobias Harris would have fell down to me, because yeah, we still needed like a small forward type of player too. And I was looking at the other Morris twin, but and I was also looking at Alex Burks too. But I feel like Vucevic is definitely the best pick, and he's definitely a good solid double-double big guy. He's a good free throw shooter to be his size too. He shoots like damn near 80%. That's great for a center. I'm going with that pick.
All right, cool. So I agree with that pick. I think that's a good pick for a rebuilding team, because essentially it's just like Orlando when they took them.
Yeah,
What the hell did Orlando have? They were post Dwight. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So, yeah. I feel you. All right. So Ken, number nine, you got Charlotte. Who you taking?
Damn. So I was hoping B wouldn't pick Vucevic because I really wanted him. For the Charlotte team, they are a hot mess in terms of roster. They when I look at it, they got Maggette, Tyrus Thomas, and Augustine was still there, so I think he could be serviceable. They need a shooting guard and a center, so I'm gonna go with Jonas Valanciunas.
Okay.
And hope that DJ Augustin can hold it down for now, because I was looking at Brandon Knight, but I think I'm gonna go on the inside and solidify that interior for Charlotte.
But so at number 10, I have the Indiana Pacers. And looking at their roster, obviously Paul George was young. Danny Granger was coming off an injury and trying to reestablish himself. The year prior, they took Tyler Hansbrough. We still got Roy Hibbert. I think this is a team that's on the cusp. At the point guard position, we got TJ Ford and Darren Collison. Here they got PG as a two, also Mike Dunleavy as a two. But when I look at everything that I have left, for me, I think the player that I'm taking would be Amon Shumpert. And the reason why I would take Amon Shumpert here is because I feel that Danny Granger, you know, at this point in his career, didn't have the perimeter defense needed anymore. And I think if you, with Paul George's offense ascending, and I know, you know, my point guard situation is borderline at best. I know Amon could slide over there, definitely guard those tougher ones. That's who I would take, because I think pairing him with Paul George at that point in their career would have made us an even more defensive juggernaut.
Hey, FIFO, when you look at the rosters, you doing 2011 and 12?
No, 10-11.
10-11?
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to do 10-11.
Yeah, because I at first I looked at 11-12, but then after I heard B, it's 10-11.
Yeah, okay, just want to make sure.
Mm-hmm. But all righty, so moving on to pick number 11. Hold on, let me go back to this. What team is that?
That's the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, Golden State. So you got Golden State, Nick. Who you taking?
You son of a – I'm pissed because you took Iman. I wanted to take Iman because that's the next, I guess, the next best thing for what they needed as a Klay Thompson replacement. But looking at this roster, they still have Monte Ellis. They still got Steph. And they actually still got David Lee coming. I think this is when he got traded from New York to Golden State. So I think to pair with that, I'm going to go with Enes Kanter. Just because you get you pretty much get a big man that can rebound and can give you some offensive buckets. He's not going to provide you that much with defense, but I think that as far as rebounding and that offensive presence, I think that's good enough for the 11th pick of the draft.
All right, so number 12 is Utah. Shelton, who you taking?
And Nick, you picked Markieff, right?
No, I picked Marcus.
You picked Marcus? Okay, yeah. Good. My pick was actually going to be Ennis if he made it past you just now, but I'm going to pick Markieff. And the reason why I'm picking Markieff, the other Morris twin, is because this team, like we said before, with this roster, is pretty loaded in Utah. B picked Klay Thompson, so we got the shooting guard position pretty much solidified. We're pretty solid across the board. The only other person I was thinking about maybe was Reggie Jackson, maybe. But I think Markieff learning behind Paul Millsap and maybe Derek Favors playing more to five, I think he'd be a good fit here on this team because he can kind of go between the three and the four.
That's what's up. All right, so number 13 is Phoenix, and that goes to B. Who are you taking in Phoenix, B?
All right, so looking at this roster there, they are definitely in need of a small forward. This roster is kind of terrible too, though. But definitely in need of a small forward or someone that can shoot the rock. Because, like I said, you had Hita Turkoglu past his prime. This was right before Nash was about to go to L.A. Past his prime. You had an aging Grant Hill. You had a Josh Childress, who was getting ready to go to play overseas. He was about to be done in the NBA. So my pick, and I had a feeling nobody was going to get him, but knowing what I know now, I'm picking Boja Bogdanović. Whatever how you say his name.
What? I was gonna say he's the only one left. I thought he was gonna say Chandler Parsons.
Oh no, no, no. I was Bojan Bogdanovic. He's a small forward. He's 6'8", 6'9" guy. Can shoot that bad boy. His average has been going up every single year. He's been consistently, slowly increasing. So yeah, that's what I hate. He'd be on my Phoenix squad. On this Phoenix squad.
What pick is that again? 13?
Yep. Phoenix Suns.
And then Ken is pissed. So who you taking for Houston, Ken?
Oh man, he kind of messed me up because the Rockets this year, they got Lowry, Dragic, Kevin Martin. They needed a small forward. And he was going to be my guy. They had Scola and then Yao Ming. Remember, Yao Ming got hurt. That was his last year. So I guess at this point, damn. Yeah, you messed me up, D.
my bad.
Let me see what I got on my big board here.
There's a name that you can still take.
Man. Let me get Tristan Thompson, man. I'll take Tristan Thompson. We lost Yao Ming. I know I'll get defense in terms of rebounding, blocks. He can guard the perimeter. He can switch out. I don't know if they were doing all the stuff they were doing now, but we've seen him guard guys on the perimeter. So given my need at center. I'll take Tristan Thompson. Oh, B jacked me up, though.
I thought you was going to go with Mirotić.
Nah, because I already have Scola. Mirotić don't play defense. All he does is really shoot. And Scola was putting up like 18 points a game. I don't know what he did the year after, but, he did play well at that fourth spot.
Yeah.
I could have went with Chandler Parsons, but he broke down.
Yeah, he injury riddled. There's too many injuries.
After his fifth year, so you got him on his rookie deal. After that fifth year, let him go. Don't re-sign him.
Now, we'll go because Kevin Martin was putting up 23. We got Dragic. We'll make it work.
Yeah, and we know Tristan to be like a crazy rebounder. So any team – like he instantly makes any team that just a little bit better. Just because he could rebound at that rate. So the last pick is me in this redraft, and it is the Milwaukee Bucks at number 15. When I look at this roster, I'm just like, what is the direction?
No, you mean the Pacers.
At number 15?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wait, hold on. Am I tripping? So I had two Pacers picks? Hold on.
Some GM. How much you want him to pay?
I know.
My bad.
You want me to pay you half a mil for this?
Hey, Ken, you just need to keep Tristan Thompson away from them Kardashians. You be straight, all right?
Wait, hold on. So who did I draft at number 10?
Number 10 was the Bucks.
Oh. See, okay, so I messed up. So I was drafting 10 for the Pacers, not Milwaukee.
You can't take it back now.
No, I can't take it back. But Iman still works with the damn Milwaukee Bucks anyway. So I'm looking at the Pacers, and I have what I have left. Okay, hold on. Let me see. That's easy. For me – hold on, let me see. One more thing, one more time. I'm going to say, damn, that really threw me off. I'm going to take, That really threw me off. I'm going to take Mirotic. Because the Pacers, even though they have Mike Dunleavy, that can go play small ball four, he mentally was never ready for that. And I think adding the EuroLeague MVP to that Pacers squad to have a legit stretch four, because again, Mike Dunleavy, he can play stretch four, but even though that wasn't his thing, Tyler Hansbrough, 15-foot range. We know Roy Hibbert is going to be around the basket. Jeff Foster as well. So they didn't have a guy that can really stretch the defense. So to me, I'm taking Mirotić for the Pacers.
That's a good fit.
Yep. Damn, so I took Iman for the Milwaukee Bucks at number 10, which I still think he was the best player available. But, man, the Bucks, that's a horrible roster, man.
I wanted Iman for Golden State. That's why I was like, I was pissed when you said his name, because he would have been perfect with Golden State at that position.
Yeah, but like looking at this, he still fits, because we're talking. Okay, they have Michael Redd. I don't know, man. Like this roster has like no direction, but I think Iman will come in and fit in at that 1-2 position with them. So it still fits.
Y'all want to do five more? We got a little time. I know, FIFA, you had a hard out, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But I would rather talk about the Jordan stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll revisit this, because we got what's the next one? They wanted us to do 2013? 2012?
We wanted to do 12 and 13.
So we'll just do 2012 next time then.
Mm-hmm.
But that's our draft. Y'all let us know in the comments who won that draft, who's the best GM. Obviously, FIFO out, because he forgot.
No, fuck. It still work.
Still work. We're going to move on to the probably most talked about documentary outside of Tiger King this year so far. This is The Last Dance. Covering the final championship of the 90s Bulls run. First thoughts. Coming out of that, they released the first two episodes. So first thoughts after the second episode.
Wow. It was, for me, it was everything I thought it would be. And I can't wait to see the next one. You know, what's crazy is, you know, when we talk about it, I don't know how y'all tell people about it, but I don't say, are y'all watching that Bulls documentary? I'm like, are you watching the Jordan documentary? Because that's really what it was. It was Jordan and them. But it was good, man. It was good. It was what I thought it would be.
You know what was interesting? A thought that went through my head. Yeah, I definitely found it entertaining. You know, most of the stuff, you know, I knew. But I liked the way they kind of put it together to kind of set a narrative and to follow through with it. I thought it was dope. And they really building it so far early on around Jerry Krause.
Yes.
And that's what I've gathered. We'll see where it goes from here. But I love the backstory. I loved Pippen's backstory, man. And what I found most interesting is that the guys that are really, really hungry are driven. When you talk about getting it out of the mud, that's it. Like, you have to go through adversity. There has to be something in you that drives you to just be great. And it could be family. It could be, you know, as the case of Pippen, just getting out of the house, you know, to escape from the realities of his world and using that to drive him, taking a bad contract as well. And one thing that popped in my head when they were showing the 63-point game against the Celtics was that people talk about that game, but oftentimes they never mention the fact that he lost.
Right.
Yeah. I forgot that he lost.
He lost both of those games, putting up 49 and 63 points.
Yep.
And when that Patson shot went in, I know that wasn't the beginning of him trusting his teammates, but it felt like it was going to be, because they won the game without him. But yeah, I was just thinking, I don't know why that popped in my head, but yeah, it's a great thing. But I would just imagine if that was any other player in today's world, Kevin Durant, Curry, whatever, LeBron, et cetera, the list goes on. People would definitely mention the loss, but they don't do that with Jordan. I think that signifies to me that he really is held in such this high esteem, like this high regard, like he's basically a basketball god, that they don't even care about that.
And another thing too, Ken, you know what they failed to mention too is in those two games that he scored a whole bunch of points and lost, they don't mention the game after 63. He only scored 19 points and he fouled out. He got like pretty much DJ locked him up. Like, you know, he did a good job of containing him and he fouled out. But they always fail to mention that shit every time. But like you said, they put him in so high regard that it's like, oh, 63 points, a playoff record. Like, but you lost the game. And it's amazing to me that, I ain't gonna say amazing, because I remember this back in the day too. But like the fact that they used to award player of the games, no matter if the team or the player won or lost. You know, usually now, if you look in kind of recent years, you ain't going to be awarded player of the game unless your team won. But, like, Jordan was awarded player of the game.
Right.
Both of those games, and they still lost. That's crazy.
Let me comment on that. One thing about that, though, is if you look at it, it wasn't just the people that felt that way. Bird said it. Bird said that was God that we played against. So when you got people on the court that felt that way about that game, that's why he was held in such high regard. So what just fans that said it was Jordan that did this, it was the opposing team that was saying, I can't believe this man scored 63 on us, and we couldn't stop him. So that's what –
I think that just talks about just how the mentality or the mindset of the media was back then versus now, because now you have more voices that's contributing to the conversation with social media. You have the hot take media now as well on the debate show. So I guarantee that somebody somewhere would point that out instead of, like, acknowledging what this guy was able to do, especially coming off a broken damn foot.
True. You know? And I think the other thing, too, that we have to take into account in terms of context is that the shape of how we view what a successful career is or a dominant career in the NBA is was still being shaped, right? Because as good as Magic was and as good as Bird was, right, collectively they dominated the league, but individually they really didn't dominate the league. They didn't dominate commercialism. They didn't dominate a lot of those other things. So kind of when Jordan – like we started to put into context what he was accomplishing, he became the standard because there was no standard prior to. Like there was no standard like, okay, this is the GOAT. This is what you got to do to become GOAT status. We didn't talk about basketball in that context until after MJ.
Because it was a lot about team, right? And that was one of the things that Bird said. They it's almost like they knew he was going to go get his, because he was probably really all they had. But he said it. We just stuck to the game plan and we won.
They won, yeah. Okay. You got to think. This was the 86 Celtics. This is like one of the teams that's considered one of the top teams in NBA history, the 86 Celtics. So it's like –
what is it, five Hall of Famers?
Yeah, five Hall of Famers. You also look at their record. They were 67-15. The Bulls made it to the playoffs with 30 wins. There was no – if the Bulls would have won one game in that series.
That would have been amazing.
One of my takeaways from this documentary is just the relationship between Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. I love the fact that Jordan always says, if you ever mention Michael Jordan, you got to mention Scottie. Like, he always give him his props and how he couldn't have won those titles without him. However – during that last year, that season, he had his gripes against Scottie based off of him taking that surgery so late, based off of just some decisions Scottie was making. But from Scottie's standpoint, it was like, I'm trying to be compensated for my time here, my role here. I'm one of the greatest players of all time.
But you're only getting paid more than me.
Exactly. And he said, I'm like, how the hell do you sign a $18 million contract? Like,
but you got to think, I mean, at the time, I give Scottie a little pass because, you know, with the situation with his dad and his brother, you know, he probably saw that 18 mil and was like, oh, shit, I can do a lot with my family with this.
But, I mentioned Jordan, but obviously he found out quick that that contract was shit.
Right, I mentioned
Jordan's gripes against him for that. It's like, bro, you literally the biggest superstar in the world right now. Like, you don't have to worry about some of the shit that I got to worry about. I would think that Jordan, based on their relationship, would understand that and maybe even try to extend some help to him, because obviously Jordan is a great businessman. He can somehow, some way, talk to management or something. I felt like Jordan could have done something, but he didn't.
Not his and business. He called him
selfish. Exactly. Yeah. No.
That contract didn't say Michael Jeffrey Jordan. It says Scottie Pippen. You know what I'm saying? So
that's your boy, though.
But it doesn't matter, though. He's my boy on the court. Off the court, in business, you got to handle your own affairs. Like, you're the one that has to be able to – you're the one that has to be able to navigate all of that, right? Because at the end of the day, like, what it look like if I'm KD? Hey, Steph, you think I should sign this contract? What? No, bruh. You are your own entity. You need to handle your
business. I'm talking about as far as – you understand what the holdout that Scotty was trying to do. Like, Jordan has to go up to man. Just like, remember when, I don't know if whoever did this for the Cowboys, when Emmitt Smith held out, and then somebody went up to manage, like, bro, we need to get this dude in the building. Do what you ever got to do to make sure that he's good.
Football's a little different, though, because the contracts are not guaranteed. You can move money around. You can do a lot of stuff, right? The NBA is a little bit different. If that's what he signed to – and you agree to terms when you agree to terms, it is your job to be out here on this basketball court. I'm talking like I'm Michael, to help me win these damn basketball games. You are under contract. You could have been, you know, taking that. I felt Jordan, but I also felt Pippen. Like, I felt them like, hey, bro, I'm not going to mess up my summer. Y'all don't even care about me like that.
Exactly.
I understood it. I understood both perspectives. If I was Scotty, I probably would have handled it the same way. If I was MJ, I would have said the same exact things. Hey, bro, you should have been did that. You should have been here at the beginning of the season ready to go.
Yeah, $18 million to a guy that probably was on a dirt road. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, can't see what I'm talking about.
People back then in the 80s, bro.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what I said. I'm not gonna like look at Pippen and call it stupid. It's just like thinking, like Ken said, look at the situation he was getting out of. Yeah, that $18 million out of 7 years at that time, that shit looked like it was a lot of money. This was what, 87, 88 or whatever when he signed that? I can't fault him. Now, his agent should have probably went back up and like, okay, let's when they won like the first title or something, all right, let's renegotiate some things here. Like, let's talk some shit, because this $18 million in 7 years.
That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking. Like, this is towards the sixth title. So they've won five already, and he's still on that whack-ass deal. Like,
agent, at that point,
it's also up to the owner, too. If the owner says, look, this is what you are contractually – obligated to, then you just got to do what you got to do. If he's not willing to renegotiate, and they said it in the doc, like, we already knew Jerry Krause and the owner, Jerry Reinsdorf, this is your contract. This is what you're going to play for.
So, going off of that, the first two episodes heavily criticized Jerry Krause and just the Bulls organization management level. Do y'all feel like he was bashed too harshly? Because, because I'm looking at it from nowadays. We talk about the Bill Belichick thing. And I think someone mentioned in the doc that you'd rather get rid of someone earlier than later. It felt like he was like, this run is going to end, and I want to catch it earlier before it ends, before I can rebuild it. It's too late. You know what I mean?
So I don't think that he got unjust due. And I don't think that they bashed him too hard. I think it was very fair, because – he was the one after Jordan's second year. It's like, oh, okay, so he is legit. They went and got Pippen. They drafted Pippen. They got Horace Grant. Like they started to make moves. Jerry Krause was the one of the first people to go overseas and actually bring somebody back that can actually hoop, in Tony Kukoc. So I think he got a lot of praise. In terms of the Bill Belichick thing, moving off of somebody a year too early versus a year too late, Jordan was still – you know, it was funny. Me and my homie Nigel, we were just talking about this. Jordan and LeBron at year 35 were still dominant enough to not get rid of them. They didn't fall off a cliff. Jordan wasn't off a cliff. Jordan wasn't the young Jordan no more. He wasn't, you know, jumping jumping over two or three people, yamming on people and stuff like that. But he was still dominant. They were still winning. So to me, if I'm the owner and I'm the GM, I would take it on a year or two basis. I'm not going to commit long-term to guys that are 35, 36, 37. Hell no, that's dumb as hell as an organization. But we're winning. Why rebuild it for the next thing when we can possibly win one or two or maybe three more championships out of it?
Go ahead. Not even just that. He's putting butts in the seats, and he's selling jerseys. He's selling merchandise. These people are making money hand over fist. Let him do what he do. Just leave him alone. Hey, man, however long you want to be here.
Yep. So to me, like the whole Phil Jackson thing, I would have gave him, you know, 1 year, $6 million, $8 million, whatever would have made Phil Jackson happy. And I would have told him, I said, hey, we're just going to go year to year as long as we can keep the band together. Jordan, you want 33? You know what? Next year I'm going to give you 30, but we got to pay Pippen, though. And we got to pay Phil. So if y'all want to keep it together, these are the sacrifices you're going to have to. As ownership and GM, I wouldn't have taken that control over. I would have been like, look, we are a great organization. And when I mean we, I mean the players. I mean us here in the office as well.
I mean Jordan.
Jordan. Whatever. All I'm saying is as ownership and the GM, I would have gave the power to the players and the head coach. My top two guys, hey, what do y'all want to do? Y'all want to come back next year? By all means, I'll give you a one-year deal, however much money, and I'm going to give Phil the same thing.
But why would you do that now when you've never done it before? Basically, I'm asking because he's the one who set up this whole thing, really. All the moves, and even during this season, how he traded Oakley for Cartwright and all that.
Hold on. The Oakley move was early on. It wasn't that.
It was like 86, 87, something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. It was after Jordan's rookie year that he moved on from Oakley.
After Scottie's rookie year.
Center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scottie's rookie year.
Exactly. Scottie's
rookie year. Remember he slapped Scottie.
Exactly. Yeah. So Jerry Krause made a lot of moves, but in that third three-peat, or at least going – to me, I just think that you needed to do year to year because obviously you weren't going to commit a five-year contract to Michael Jordan at age 35. You weren't going to commit none of extended period of time. And even Phil Jackson, you know, the way he is, he only wanted 7 years total with the Bulls. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But I think that the top three guys, Pippen, Jordan, and Phil Jackson, understood that we're winning because of those three right there. You know what I'm saying? And I think that if those three would have said, yeah, I'm going to come back next year. You want to come back? You want to come back? And they all would have said, we'll take one-year deals. Then that's what you do. Because with those three guys, you are competing for a championship. And the first time that they lose, guess what? As management, now you have an out. You know what? We had our run. We won six titles in 7 years. And now it's just time for something new. And nobody would have been mad at that. But because you're trying to force the issue when you're still winning and literally still the best team in the NBA, what are you doing?
And I think I don't know if people are going to pick this up, but what you learned is that the players had no power.
No power.
None then.
It wasn't a players' league. It was owners, GMs, that's it. So, you know, and as Cal's pointing out in the chat, once you're in a contract, there's no renegotiating and stuff like that. You know, the CPA, I don't recall it like that, but he said it was terrible. So, you know, you were at the mercy of the organizations. So if they wanted Phil gone, then that was it. And it sounded crazy to me at the time. I was happy they were breaking that shit up because I was getting tired of the shit anyway. But, you know, even back then I felt, you know, they'll win it. They'll have a change of heart and come back. Nah, man, he was dead ass serious. And that's what we got. But yeah, I think people need to kind of look at like how things really were back then versus how they are now.
Yep.
And do a compare and contrast, because I think you'll see how really the advantage that the players are in right now.
And then also when you look at the fact that they wanted to move on from that Bulls team, what have they been since?
Right. Yep, and that was another takeaway I had is that Kraus, you know, obviously coming from the baseball, you know, sport where it is organizations truly, you know, he misjudged what Jordan was able to accomplish as one guy. Yeah, Kraus was great in building the right roster around him, but Kraus also may have been looking at that Celtics team that had like four or five, you know, Hall of Famers on that team. That was organization driven. The Lakers somewhat seemed very organizational driven, even though they had superstars as well. But, you know, with the Bulls, it was MJ Pippen driven. And of course, Phil Jackson, then there was everybody else that came along after it. The last thing I have is I thought it was interesting when Jordan did the interview. And even I forgot this, how the Sixers were looked at back then. They're often, from what I recall and what I see now, they're not normally mentioned with the Bulls with the Celtics and the Lakers back then. But it was interesting hearing Jordan say that, yeah, I want to turn the Bulls into a respected organization like the Sixers, Lakers, and Celtics. I thought that was an interesting soundbite.
Well, because I think that Dr. J was the first MJ. And I think that Black and American
Scotty mentioned that too.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of where that comes from. And then also you look at all of the legends that went through Philly. But I agree. Like, people don't necessarily talk about Philly at that level, but bro, they had Moses, that Dr. J,
Maurice Cheeks, on that team.
They had a lot.
Al Greer, and that's what I was saying is like they're forgotten. Forgotten, but they were a really successful franchise and won titles back then.
Because they weren't necessarily. They were almost like pre-San Antonio, where they never really won back-to-back. You know what I'm saying? Like, they didn't necessarily dominate like that. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like they were dominant. Yes, they were a good organization. Yeah, they had Hall of Famers. But even Detroit won back-to-back. You know what I'm saying? They never won back-to-back. And I think that's kind of what hurt them.
Yeah, Philly kind of snuck theirs in between the Celtics and the Lakers.
Yep.
One of the best quotes I got from the doc was, I forgot who said it, but he was like, I think Michael Jordan doing his job is better than anybody else doing their job in reference to Kraus. So I think Kraus, there is a lot to respect him for. However, I do think he undervalued all of his – he was just basically like the old school way of basketball organizations being run, like y'all mentioned. Like, I'm the one who's controlling everything. I put this together. Y'all not winning titles before me. Jordan didn't win before me type stuff. So I think he had a big ego in that.
You blame him, though?
That's why I asked that question, because I'm like, he did put this team together, and as a GM, you always look forward. You're always thinking this year and 5 years from now. And I do think that he overvalued himself, but it's not by that much. Like, I think he should be. It's funny that I don't really know his name like that, and learning about everything that he's done is like, why isn't he spoken as like one of the fifth names when you talk about Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Phil Jackson, Dennis Rodman? Like, you know what I'm saying? You know all these names, but Jerry Krause is like a name that you don't really mention that much.
I didn't know that they just outwardly clowned a man like that. That was interesting. Cussed his ass out and did everything. Like, I don't know many places where a black man can cuss out a white man and get away with it. You know, like, especially back then, that was crazy, man. Like, there's not a job I know where you can go cuss out your boss.
With that shit. He was like, Kraus, you gonna do layups with us? He was like, yeah. He was like, well, we gotta lower the rim.
Yeah, man. Pippen cussing him out to the point Phil was like, hey man, you gotta cut that shit out, bro. Like, that's insane, man. But you know.
Another thing that I thought was interesting and insane is that how straight edge Jordan was, or I guess try to portray himself, because he talked about that time he going to that room at that hotel and he see cocaine, weed, and women, and he talking about some I'm out. I'm like, come on, man.
Yeah, what I did when I was watching, I was like, let me go see who was on that team his rookie year, and considering how bad they were, I kind of got and understood why they were doing what they were doing. again, it was just a job for them. They really didn't care. They were doing something they loved for fun, got paid to do it. It wasn't a lot of money, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, what something else that they could have been doing. And but, yeah, it was Orlando Woodridge was on that team, mm-hmm. and it was somebody else. I recognize Orlando. I can't remember any of the other guys like that. I mean, I was freaking eight, you know, when Jordan was drafted. So I don't recall a lot of shit back then.
Yeah. You know, like one of the biggest takeaways that I had from this whole thing was the fact that the mystique of the Bulls was so great that nobody outside of, you know, if you were Associated Press or, you know, a writer, a beat writer, so like, the people that knew, but to the outside, this was like unbreakable. Like, growing up, I always thought the bond between Pippen and Jordan was unbreakable. Like, they always saw things eye to eye. Like, just that mystique, like, this literally uncovered everything. You know, and we're two out of 10 in. You know what I'm saying? And obviously growing up, being older, I kind of knew that. But if I just go back to when I was a kid, because think about it, Jordan was drafted the year I was born. So I didn't – the Jordan I saw was the Jordan winning championships. You know what I'm saying? So when I turned six is when he won his first one. And that's when I started watching basketball. So I saw Jordan as the winner.
Yeah, I didn't fully formed.
Exactly. I didn't see all of the
trials. You didn't see the struggle, Jordan.
Exactly. You know, and obviously being older and not having YouTube, I went back to go see it. But to hear it and see it through his eyes, through his perspective, it was different. Like, that mystique, it was just like, damn, it was great, but it wasn't that great. Like, in terms of everything that was happening, you know, so that was very interesting for me.
You know why? Because the media wasn't what it eventually became. Because SportsCenter wasn't really all that big at that time, so you didn't have this statewide international coverage. You know, a lot of it was very, very local. So if you were in Chicago, you got those stories from the beat writers. But if you were not, then you're not really going to hear that much of it, unless you got like a USA Today or whatever paper, even if they covered it on a wider scale like that. But yeah, a lot of it was local. But ESPN, when they came along, man, and when Jordan really became a superstar, it started to change everything. So now you started to hear not only news from the Bulls, but everybody else. Yeah. So you heard all those discontent and stories. But back in the day, they were able to kind of keep a lot of that stuff silent.
Yep.
One of the last questions I got for y'all is, did y'all know, like, Phil Jackson, how he had a theme? Was that well documented that he themed every season, pretty much? Even this one, as far as The Last Dance?
Mm-mm. I didn't know that, and I grew up in Chicago.
And to me, because I was like, that's interesting, because it's like how they all knew. It's very rare that a dynasty knows when it's going to end, right? That you all know, like, this is it, enjoy it, because after this, we're done. And for them to still execute from the beginning of the season with all the stuff and the craziness of business and contracts dealing the summer going all the way into the beginning of the season, and how Jordan had to basically just redefine the Bulls for the last run to start off the year, like, how Phil was still able to coach through that. And to me, it added another layer of respect that I have for Phil as a coach. As far as, like, with all that was beaten on him, he still was – I know they had that one scene where he slammed the door shut after a few losses, but still he sounded calm and that leadership role that you would want from your head coach. Like, I think that was just something that stood out to me.
Yeah,
I agree.
The point that B was making, like, you can't undermine the value of a great coach, because it's not just about getting on you. It's not about pointing out what you do good or what you do bad. It's about having that calming factor, because, bro, in a basketball game, in sports, whatever sport you play, you're going to be in situations that are crazy, that are going to be emotionally, you know, all over the place. And you need one or more entities, and typically that's your coach, to be able to bring that calm factor. All right, cool. that happened. Don't worry about it. This is how we're going to win. You know what I'm saying? And always instilling that confidence. And that's why Jordan didn't win before having Phil. That's the reason why the Lakers didn't win before the Kobe Shaq Lakers didn't win before having Phil. That's why Phil is who he is, because in professional sports, it's more than X's and O's. It's about managing egos and expectations. And I can honestly say that in my lifetime, there has not been another coach, maybe Bill Belichick, that's been greater at managing egos and getting everybody on the same page to accomplish one thing.
Yeah, he's definitely up there for me. I don't know. I got to look at the list again, but yeah, you'll be hard pressed to find anybody better than Phil. Any other last thoughts on the first two episodes of the doc? Or do y'all like where it's going so far? Like, as far as how it's setting everything up?
Yeah, honestly, you know, one of the main things that I like is how they show different timelines, right? Like different years, and how something like in 98 was triggered by something in the 80s. You know what I'm saying? And something that happened in the 80s, you see, oh, in 92, like this was a direct correlation of that. Like I liked how they kind of jumped all over the place, but they kind of kept one line of sight. You know what I'm saying? So I thought that was
Yeah, because really it looked like they're going to do that with the next episode, how they're going to tie in like wherever he was going with trying to get past the Pistons. That leads to the 97-98 year. So me as a Pistons fan, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that, how they going to talk about like the bad boy, his bad boy struggles before he had to cross over that hurdle to get to where he's at. So,
and one more thing, even though, you know, B's birthday is the 30th of this month and it's canceled, mine is the 26th and it's canceled, the fact that part two is coming out on my birthday, that's a nice consolation prize. I'll take
it. So you would take it, huh?
I'll take it. I can't do nothing else. I'll take that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that shit, man. Like, I mean, you know, as a basketball fanatic, as someone that's like a huge fan of basketball itself, I'm interested in this documentary, no question. But as someone that wasn't really a fan of Jordan, I'm like, man, fuck Jordan. I'm like, fuck the Bulls. Fuck whatever, whatever. That's the half side. Like the half of me. Is looking at the other half like, man, why the fuck you watching this? But then the other half is like, yo, man, but you fucking love basketball. This is your love right here. Like, so like, yeah. And like, I like to see like the minds of great basketball players rather than even if it's players that I'm not really a fan of, like Jordan. I want to know what makes Jordan tick. I want to see what makes Scottie Pippen tick. Like what's going to make Rob, like I like seeing stuff like that and hearing players talk about that and getting their perspective from certain situations. So,
yeah. And even back then, he was talking shit about tanking. What we know is tanking.
Right. What we know is tanking now. Yeah. 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 Like, man. And always coming to play. Like, always coming to play. Like, you know that somebody that's in that arena, people or person, have never seen you play before. I'm about to go out and give it 150% every time.
And even off of coming, like, an injury that could destroy his career, like when he broke his foot. Like, talking about how he would sneak and play with the college athletes, yeah, like some pickup games, and how that increased. Like,
man, you always want to hoop. You just all, I mean, you live and bleed that shit. That's all you want to do. You don't want to take no games off. You don't want to take, oh, let me, since we got a back to back, let me go rest on this day. Like, all you want to do is freaking hoop, and that's what you got to do. That's what you are. You a hooper, you hoop. So I love it, man. I love that.
All right, that's all I got for us today.
Cool. Yeah, cool. Well, we appreciate you guys showing up again to watch us while we're in the middle of this pandemic, man. We're talking about doing something for the draft live. So that's in discussion. So we'll see how that goes. But for now, we'll catch you guys next Monday. Make sure you guys subscribe just in case we do go live, because you never know. You don't want to miss out.
You never know, right. It might pop up. You might get that notification. Oh, shit, we live. Pop us on your TV, son. Don't watch it on your phone.
Yep. So we'll catch y'all next time. We out. Peace.
Peace.
Peace.